Following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Welcome to Why We Cook on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. And I just got new glasses. If you know me, you know I've worn glasses since I was 7 years old. And now that I am over 40, my eye doctor has informed me that it's time for bifocals. Yes. Or as they're now called, progressives. There are no more visible lines in bifocals. I didn't know that. I think that's supposed to make us older folks feel better about having to wear them because you can't see the line, so it doesn't say to the world, I'm old, I need bifocals. I suppose, I don't know. So I got them, and they're hard to get used to, these progressives. I feel like I'm a progressive kind of person. Not so good with the progressive lenses. They're making me kind of like a little dizzy and kind of queasy. I feel like I've had them for about 24 hours now. It's getting better. I'm getting used to them. But it's not an easy thing to go from regular to progressive. Makes me feel somewhat conservative, actually. But what's funny is that, you know, I'm wearing these very 21st century progressive high-tech lenses, but they're ensconced in frames that I could have bought in, like, 1953. Because I, too, have succumbed to the Mad Men era retro glasses craze that's sweeping the country. Everywhere I look now on the subway, I see people wearing the same black framed square glasses that my parents both wore when I was a little kid. So I didn't get those. These are round. They're the same era, but they're round. But I, you know, you ride the L train or the G train here in New York, and it's all you see. Although I have to set the record straight, because back in the 80s, I actually had those square black retro style glasses because I wanted to be Elvis Costello, or at least I wanted to look like him, or a short female version of him. And back then you could only get those frames from places that sold glasses to people with Medicare and Medicaid. Those were like the welfare glasses, and they kept them in a special box. They didn't even have them on display. I had to explain to the guy what I wanted, and he was like, oh yeah, you want the Medicare glasses. And he pulled them out of this like dusty old box and laughed at me because I wanted them. But it was okay. I was happy to wear them back then. And I was very poor back then, and they were way cheaper than anything else at the time, and way, way, way cheaper than what I just had to shell out for these new retro glasses. But anyway, so I'm trying to get used to them, and I'm coming along slowly. Stairs are a little bit tricky, a little bit trippy. Not literally tripping, but they're a little trippy. And cooking has been interesting too, since, you know, that's what I do. Well, really, I teach. I don't really cook that much, actually, but when I do cook. So when you wear these, you have to angle your head down because you have to see through the zone of the lens. You can't just move your eyes down because it's blurry down at the edges. I still don't really get it. The woman who sold them to me in the store said, oh, don't worry, I'll train you on them. I've been wearing glasses since I was 7 years old. I don't think I need training, but she said, you have to point your nose where you want your eyes to go now. You can't just move your eyes. You actually have to move your head. So I'm trying. I'm pointing my head all over the place. I look sort of like a dizzy pigeon pointing my head all over. But it's okay. I can deal with it. It's just, you know, it's one more thing to adjust to. We all have to learn to adjust to new things throughout life. Roll with it. There are certain things I can adjust to, like this. There are certain things I refuse to believe I'm going to have to adjust to, like, for example, somebody like Michelle Bachmann for president. I can adjust to the idea of never eating tuna again. I'm fine with that forever and ever. I'm okay with that. Tuna, to me, I always thought it was a little overrated. I didn't really get it. And I don't really like canned tuna, so it's okay. I can adjust to that. The other thing, the Michelle Bachmann thing, I can't even begin to contemplate that. So I'm just going to leave that. But, you know, life is about making constant change and making adjustments. And that's how you mature and that's how you grow, right? Being flexible and adaptable. That's the way to put the positive spin on it, is that you're being flexible and adaptable. The mini daikon that I planted this spring in the garden never actually formed any mini daikon. Just a lot of leaves. So what do? I pulled them out. I cut off the leaves and ate them and threw away the immature roots. And then I replanted arugula. See? Flexible and adaptable. My upcoming trip to Arizona may be derailed by raging wildfires. So we'll just go further west. That's okay. I'm adapting. The three vintage knoll chairs that I found in the garbage that I need to get restored, and the restorers want $350 a piece to redo the cushions, I'll do it myself. I'm flexible. I can cut out foam rubber and clean some old pieces of vintage wool. I don't need to spend $1,000 to get three pieces of foam rubber cut. I'll do it myself. So you have to be that way in life. Challenges come, you roll with it. And I think you have to be that way too when you cook and when you shop and when you plan meals. I think a lot of people approach cooking from the wrong end. They approach it from the finished meal end and work backwards. They think, well, what do I want to eat? And then they go to the store and they get it, knowing that an American supermarket will have just about everything that they'll want, regardless of season, regardless of location. I want to eat this. My store will have this. But how good is it going to be? What's the quality of it going to be like? How fresh or how seasonal or how nutritious will it be? You know, how will it have impacted the land it was grown in or the people who grew it? You know, or did it just come from a factory? I don't know. I mean, now I know that saying this on air here is like preaching to the converted. You all my listeners, all Heritage Radio listeners, are all CSA members and farmers market shoppers. And we like to go out and see what's available and know what's in season and then build meals around those choices. I know that's what we all do. We're not the type who work backwards, but people do. And I think it's really important to sort of encourage people to think from the other end. Think from the source end and work toward the finished meal. Don't think about the finished meal and then work backwards. Like, for example, right now it's rhubarb season. And it's rhubarb and strawberry season, actually. But only for a couple weeks. The strawberries will be gone by the 4th of July. Gone. So I got this big bunch of rhubarb that was left over from an event I did. And it was all cut up already, so we couldn't reuse it, so I took it home. I liberated it. And I went to the store and I bought organic strawberries because strawberries are just too pesticide-laden to buy conventional. So I cooked it all up this weekend. I put the rhubarb and the strawberries in a pot with some sugar, tiny pinch of salt, and I just cooked it all up into like a big stewy pile of strawberry rhubarb goop. And I've been eating it since the weekend with Greek yogurt that I mix with a little bit of buckwheat honey, because buckwheat's my favorite honey. It's sort of like a pie-less pie or an uncrumbled crumble. It's the filling without the crust. There's nothing encasing it. It's free-form pie. It's pie without any barriers. Because I always like the fillings in pies and crumbles better than the crust part, and I usually just leave the crust, so I didn't make any crust. So I ate a big bowl of pie mush this weekend, several of them actually, and I was very happy about it because in like I said, 2 more weeks or so, no mas strawberries. They'll be gone. It's sad, but it's poetically seasonal. You know, of course, you could get those terrible Driscoll's berries from California in the store all year round. But strawberries are on that list, you know, the Dirty Dozen list. There's a list of the most heavily sprayed produce around. Just Google the Dirty Dozen, not the movie, you know, the produce. And so it's probably better just to eat them in season, because if you can't get organic, eat conventional, but you're only going to eat them for a couple weeks a year, and then that's it. So you won't get that much pesticide ingested. And that's being flexible and adaptable. That's what I was talking about. Just because I can get the strawberries all year doesn't mean I'm going to get them all year. To me, strawberries outside of June are basically the taste of disappointment. And life's too short to be disappointed. So we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, more about being flexible. Listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Cane 5 Vineyards. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Erica Wides. And I'm talking tonight about needing to remain adaptable and flexible as you age. We're all getting older. Why get stuck in your ways? I had to get bifocals, progressive lenses. I'm dealing with it. It's okay. I'm a little dizzy, but I'm dealing with it. And the same applies to cooking and to sourcing your food and to eating. You can't get too stuck in what you want. You have to be sort of willing to take what comes to you. So I love the challenge of finding ways to make great food out of leftovers or random stuff that I can bring home from work or odds and ends from my fridge. And I've talked about this before. It's one of my favorite subjects. You know that I'm thrifty and I like to work within those frames for myself, within those parameters, because it's kind of a challenge. It's like being on one lifelong endless episode of Chopped. But instead of frog's legs and hamachi and Cheerios, which is what I was given when I was on Chopped, I get things like a half a head of green cabbage and a quart of leftover braised goat and a garden full of daikon tops with no radishes attached. No problem. I can make deliciousness out of just about anything. I have a few bombs once in a while, but I can do it. So over the weekend, of course, we were up at the tiny bungalow where we spend most of our summer weekends. And that's what I had to work with. And that's where I like to do my cooking because it's even more of a challenge because it's a tiny bungalow with a tiny stove and not much to work with. And I find I do my best cooking when I'm up there. I feel like the sort of the less I have to work with, the more, the better it all comes out. I also had a pack of ground venison that a coworker of mine had shot last fall. He didn't shoot a ground venison. He shot a venison and then ground it up. And I've been saving that in the freezer all winter because I wanted to eat venison burgers this summer. So we started out the weekend with those venison burgers, which were really delicious with a cabbage slaw. I took that leftover head of cabbage and I made a nice big slaw and some pickles that I had also had left over from my testing session that I talked about last week when I'm testing this dish with my buddy Beej for this food festival in Ohio that we'll be participating in next month. So we had the venison burgers with the slaw and the pickles, and that was a pretty mighty tasty meal. If you've never had ground venison, I highly recommend it. If you're a burger fan and you want to maybe not eat so much beef, nice medium rare venison burger on the grill. And so then for breakfast the next morning, I still had some uncut cabbage left, so I chopped up the cabbage and I chopped up a red onion and I threw it all in the cast iron skillet with some olive oil, and I fried that all until the cabbage got really soft and really sweet, and it started to get like kind of charry around the edges. And then I had these beautiful extra large pastured eggs that I got from the farmer's market, because I'll only buy my eggs now at the farmer's market because the industrial egg complex freaks me out. And so I cooked those eggs nice over easy, medium rare eggs. And then I also had some leftover pieces of cheese, this whole assortment of artisan goat cheese from a place called Cherry Glen Farms in Maryland. And they are being kind enough to supply us with goat cheese for this event that we're doing in July. Very nice of them. And they had sent us up a whole sampler, like their entire line. And so there was all this cheese left. So on top of the kind of charred, soft, sweet cabbage. I put a little crumbled goat cheese and then the two eggs on top. And it was really amazing. If you've never eaten cabbage for breakfast with eggs, cabbage and eggs for breakfast, I strongly suggest that this very evening, tonight, you go out, you get yourself a head of cabbage, and you cook it up in the morning. That's your homework for the week. Because you haven't eaten breakfast until you've eaten fried cabbage with eggs. Just trust me on this. I'm a professional. So then I had to deal with Father's Day, because it was Father's Day on Sunday, and you may be familiar with my father, Bernie Weitz, the host of The Naturalist here on Heritage Radio Network. Maybe you listen to his show. So he was coming up to visit for Father's Day with his longtime companion. And so I had this goat. I had this leftover braised goat that I had also kind of scavenged from some work. And so right in the town where Tiny Bungalow is a market, like a Latin market, basically. There are a lot of Ecuadorians and Mexicans in the town. And so they have this great market. And they had really good corn tortillas there. So I got some corn tortillas, warmed them up in the cast iron pan. So they got that nice kind of toasty flavor. And then served those with the warmed up braised goat, some more slaw, some more pickles, some more goat cheese, and then a big pile of lettuce and cilantro from the garden that I had grown, because that's all I have so far. And then a big blob of the rhubarb goop for dessert with yogurt. And it was a very fine Father's Day menu indeed, and everybody loved it. And it was all patched together from stuff that I had either made earlier or scavenged or salvaged or whatever, left over from other things. And I love that. It was like I only had to spend $2 for their tortillas and everything else sort of just fell into place. Now, of course, I understand that most normal people don't work in culinary schools or don't work in the industry, and they don't get to do things like bring home a quart of braised goat that just happens to be laying around. You know, if you work in an office, you work in like a graphic design firm, you don't just stumble upon braised goat there one day, maybe after company party. But that's where the planning ahead happens for the mere mortals, mortals who don't do what I do. You know, so maybe you plan ahead and you think, well, maybe on Sunday I'll get myself a nice chunk of some heritage meat, like, you know, some good pork or something, good couple of birds, and cook them up on Sunday, and then kind of plan around it. I know this sounds very like home economics, 1978, the Carter years, you know, plan your meals in advance out of leftovers. But you know what? That's how people have been eating forever until we got, you know, affluenza in the last decade, and suddenly having leftovers became seen as something negative. But I think leftovers actually make some of the best meals. So maybe on Sunday, you cook a hunk of meat, you braise something, you roast something, and then you eat it Sunday night. And then maybe like on Tuesday, you make tacos out of it. And then like Thursday, you make a soup out of it. I mean, that's the way to cook. That's how you do it. You plan it ahead. It makes it really easy. And that sort of stuff tastes better as the week goes on. I mean, that goat's going on like a week and a half now, and I ate some today, and it was great. It just gets riper. That's what it is. It's like confit. It just ripens in the fridge. So that's what I do. I'm always thinking ahead to the weekend, because the weekend is really when I get to cook for myself. And so instead of like starting from zero on Saturday morning and saying, oh my God, what are we going to eat? All week, I kind of have my eye out for like little bits and bobs and scraps and leftovers of things, and I kind of just squirrel them away until Friday. I think that probably in a past life I lived, you know, during the Depression or some era like that. It could also just be like my mother's constant fear of starvation from her childhood spent in World War II Europe. I always had this sense growing up that, you know, there was this fear that, you know, the Nazis could come knocking on the door in our suburban house any day and take everything away from us. And so you had to always plan ahead. And even though I was kind of a fat little kid and I probably could have survived pretty well for a couple of months with a little less food around, I've always sort of had that fear in me. So we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, a little more about this subject. listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back to Why We Cook. I'm Erica Wides, your host. So tonight I've been talking about being flexible and adaptable, and how that pertains to planning out what you're going to eat during the week and what you're going to cook. And maybe thinking ahead a little bit and letting things kind of fall into place, come to you. You're out shopping. You see maybe a farmer at the farmer's market selling, who knows, you know, really nice lamb. Maybe like lamb neck meat. Well, maybe I never cooked lamb necks before. Maybe you should give it a try. Take them home, braise them up, stew them up, package it out, put it in the freezer. Boom! 6 meals worth of braised lamb necks. Neck meat, by the way, is really excellent from any animal because the more that an animal part moves, the better it's going to taste. You know that. We've talked about that before here. And necks on animals move a lot. So even though neck meat can be sort of annoying because you have to bone it out, it's kind of worth the payoff. If you like things like oxtail or shanks, necks are kind of just like that. They're really good. They're a good part. So way back a long time ago when I was in college, I went to art school and I took a lot of art history classes. And we studied the Impressionists, like everyone does, and the realism movement in France in the 1800s. And there was a painting that I always loved called The Gleaners by Jean-François Millet, or Millet, as we here would say. I always actually thought it was by Courbet, and I was going to say tonight the painting by Courbet, and then I thought, let me just double check that. And thanks to Wikipedia, turns out not Courbet. It was by Millet. But anyway, this painting of The Gleaners shows French peasants in the wheat fields after the harvest, picking up the fallen wheat that had been left behind. And I always found that really moving and really profound and sort of sad. But, you know, I can't stand waste. You know that about me. And that painting always spoke to me because of that. That, you know, the farmer would come along, do their harvest, and then whatever was left in the field was, you know, the poorer people were allowed to come and pick it up. And that's certainly how it should be. My friends who own the Chef's Garden in Ohio, where I will be going for that event in July, they do that after they pick all their chili peppers. They allow all their farm workers to come back through and pick up anything they want that was left behind, because a lot of their workers are from Mexico and they like to pick up all the fallen peppers and then make hot sauce and preserve it and stuff like that. And I was out there one year on the day that they were doing that, and I thought that was kind of cool. But anyway, maybe I was a gleaner in a past life. Maybe I was a French peasant in a past life. Who knows? And then maybe I came back again during the Depression. And I was thrifty because I had to be. And then I was born again in 1967, and here I am now. But I don't know. The idea of gathering the fallen fruit has always really appealed to me. Even now, when we go apple picking in the fall, I'm always looking at what's on the ground. I mean, I look up at the trees to pick. But I'm always sort of a little bit upset by seeing perfectly good fruit on the ground that maybe just has a little bruise because it fell. And whoever I'm with always says, oh, no, don't pick that up. It's bruised. But what's wrong with it? I mean, that's the fruit that the pigs should be eating. Like, these guys should have a flock of pigs? Pigs come in a flock? Whatever it is, a herd. You know, like people have done for thousands of years when they have fruit trees, after they pick the fruit, you let the pigs loose in the orchard. The pigs clean up all that fallen fruit. The pig's meat gets really tasty and delicious and fruity tasting, and then you whack the pig in the fall and eat it, and it tastes really good. That's why pigs always traditionally had that apple in their mouth when they were roasted, because their meat tasted like pork. Makes perfect sense, doesn't it? So I always kind of feel bad for the fallen fruit, and, you know, it's like rooting for the underdog. I sort of feel for the underdog. But anyway, last week, like I said, Beej was in town, and we were walking through Union Square, through the Green Market, and it was about 7 p.m., I guess, or so, and they were starting to pack things up. And I had walked through there earlier in the day, like around noon, and I was looking at the sugar snap peas, and the sugar snap peas were $6 a pound at the Green Market. And I understand the cost of being a farmer is high, but I'm cheap and I didn't want to spend $6 a pound. So I talked myself out of it. I deliberated myself out of buying the $6 a pound peas, and I kept going. But then that night, Beach was in town. We walked through, and that same stand and everybody else was starting to pack it up, and they were packing up all their leftover stuff into bags for City Harvest. Now, City Harvest is a big clearinghouse for leftover food that goes to feed the hungry. And that's great. And where I work, we give tons of stuff to City Harvest every week, too. And I totally support their mission, and they're fine. But in their kind of haste to get it all packed up, they were dropping a lot of peas on the ground. So there were probably 3 to 5 pounds of peas just scattered around on the ground. And in my calculations, at $6 a pound, that's a lot of peas on the ground. That was like, you know, $30 worth of sugar snap peas just falling on the ground. And I had to use all of my mental and emotional strength and reserve to hold myself back from getting down on my knees and picking up all of those fallen peas and taking them and stuffing them into my backpack, because they were going in the trash. People were stepping on them, and they were sweeping up, and they were going to get thrown away. And I had just walked by there 7 hours earlier and talked myself out of buying them. And if I had gotten down on the ground at that point at noon and picked them up off the ground, I probably would have been arrested. So why couldn't I have gone down there now on my knees and picked them up, basically just to preserve my dignity and not embarrass my friend? But why not allow the modern day gleaners to come in? I'm going to start a modern day gleaner movement. I know there already is. There are the freegans and the supermarket dumpster diver guys. And that's all great. And I like what they're doing. And if I had time, maybe I would do that too. But if those farmers are going to let their precious $6 a pound peas fall to the ground as they bag them up for charity, can't I get in on that charity too? I don't make that much money. Come on. Anyway, the irony of the whole experience, of course, is that Beej and I were going to be planning, you know, and testing for this festival, and we were going to be cooking and working together all weekend, and he hates waste, but he hates leftovers, too. No, he doesn't hate waste. What am I saying? Beej has no problem with waste. I hate waste. He never takes home leftovers, and he likes to buy all kinds of stuff just to taste it and then just toss it away, and it makes me insane. So, Beej, if you're listening, this is just to remind you who you're working with. We're very different that way, and therefore, we could never have any sort of business together. I mean, I love him. I love working with him. I love what we do together, but I would kill him if we were in a business together, because I would be the one down on the ground salvaging the peas, and he would be the one sweeping them up, putting them in the garbage. So go online and look up the painting of the gleaners. And look really closely, zoom in on it. And if you look really closely, you'll see that one of the gleaners is a very short, dark-haired woman. She's wearing black-rimmed, very retro-looking glasses from another era. And she looks kind of dizzy because she's pointing her nose down toward the wheat scattered on the ground. You know who she is. We're out of time. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This week in MeetingPlace.com, a report prepared by 10 international agencies for next week's Group of 20 conference in Paris is recommending that major governments drop policies supporting biofuels because of the effect they have on global food prices. The report was generated by experts from groups such as the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. It notes that abrupt changes in the price of oil can lead to crops diverted to produce biofuels, which in turn increases food price volatility. It recommended that government subsidies that support biofuel development be abandoned, a topic that U.S. Agriculture Secretary Thomas Vilsack is expected to address on some level when he meets with the G20 on June 23rd. In an address yesterday,